session number 20983, Reel 5.
Reel 5?
Fine. Now then, these bombards, it was a stubby weapon. It was for demolishing things like pillboxes. Now, whatever this thing hit, it just powdered it. It really was a devastating weapon. The other thing that I didn't mention as well, we also had a thing called a crocodile. This was a flamethrower tank, which could squirt a flame about 200 feet in front of it. It was a dreadful weapon, believe you me. And when you saw the mess it made of houses and things like that, it's no surprise that the Germans surrendered as soon as they saw these things appear in the field. But there was one funny incident, and I must mention this. This was over the Rhine, and this is again a coincidence. When we got over the Rhine, I was in a position, and the next thing I was sent for by the company sergeant major, and he says, the CEO wants to see you. See, so I'm dashing up the CEO about a quarter of a mile away when I finally found him. He says, yes. I said, I'm Cottle Campbell, anti-tank platoon, sir. He says, right, Cottle, I'd like you to knock out these three houses. So I looked at these houses, looked at the situation. It was all open ground to our right. So I says, right, sir, I said, this is not a job really for £6. What you want here is a section of flamethrowers. Now, we had flamethrowers mounted on our Bren gun carriers. So he said, right, he says, we'll find flamethrowers. I said, but what I want you to do is bring your £6 up and give them covering fire. So I said, yeah, by all means. So I went back and I was complaining bitterly to this sergeant major that I'd been leading the attack more or less since Normandy, that we're all getting a wee bit tired. We'd been on the go for about 36 hours. I said, we hadn't an ounce of sleep, we've very little to eat. He says, I promise this corporal, he says, do this job, he says, and I'll put in reserve in the next attack. I says, fine. So having got my gun up and got it into position to cover the flank, up came these two Bren gun carriers, flamethrowers, and I noticed there was C-force. So CO briefed these two carriers, and I told them, right, we've got all half a dozen Bren guns up here and a £6. We'll give you all the cover and fire that you need, so don't worry about it, and it's going to come from these woods. So we started spraying these woods with Bren gun fire while these two vehicles drove down this track, did a skid turn at the bottom, turned about, there's three houses there, they gave them a squirt each, right through the windows, and you can actually see the flames coming up through the chimneys. So as these guys passed us, you know, going back again, you know, they were cheering and we were cheering. So we wiped these three houses out, and the CEO reckoned it was a great job done. So they were stuck for the night, and it was then that I heard that the person called David Morris, one of my platoon as well, had taken my gun position. And the slit trench that I had been occupying that day, right up to the time the CO had moved us, got a direct hit, and poor old David Morris was killed outright. So there, for the grace of God, be I, the one minute you're cursing and swearing because you were moving, and it virtually saved my life at the cost of his. So I lost another very, very close friend. Now then, again, over the Rhine, this is one of these very, very sad things that happened. My mail caught up with me, and I got a letter from my mother to say that my cousin, Frank Evans, who's in the Scots Guards, had been killed at Nijmegen in a bombing raid. Now that night, we were pulled out after that attack between the two rivers, where the Guards Armour Division, not the Guards Armour Division, the Guards Division, the all-seeing eye, was taken over for us, and we were handing over to the Coldstream Guards, and on our way back out, we ran into this bomber raid, and it was during this time that my cousin was killed. Now, at the end of the war, I was still only 19, and he was a year younger than me, so he could only have been very, very early 18s or late 17s when he was killed. But again, I lost six on my mother's side during the war. He was one of them. So anyway, having said that, we then moved up to the Elbe. Again, there wasn't a lot of firing, there wasn't a lot of action. But when we got up to the Elbe, we looked across there, and it was virtually a cliff in front of us. It must have been at least this escarpment, 300 or 400 yards high, 300 or 400 feet high, covered in woods. You couldn't see a damn thing. Anyway, what they did was they put a smoke screen down and kept blasting this thing away 24 hours a day. They were shelling that particular area, which was opposite where we were going to cross. Now, 227 Brigade was held reserve on this one, and I believe the attack was led by 46 Brigade, as well as the commandos. So it was a very successful attack. It was put in first light. They got across all right. We went across them at midday. And it was during this time that we actually saw these German jet fighter bombers at close hand. They come down and Strafford runs right down the river trying to bomb the bridges and strafing us at the same time. And then we had a very funny incident as well. It's written in our history somewhere, where we actually captured German frogmen. And somebody said in a very Scottish accent, that's what you call the Herren folk. So we still can't retain our sense of humour. But having said that, we then got over the Elbe, got into our assembly area. And we're not quite sure to this day. They reckon it was one of our own shells that fell short. But again, these things happen. A shell landed in this quarry where we're assembling and killed 8 non-commissioned officers that was at an O group. So, you know, it really was awful. Now, at this time, we're meeting more and more Germans. A lot of them wanted to surrender, a lot of them didn't. We kept running into these roadblocks. One of our anti-tank guns, manned by Davy Trail, who had been with Normandy with me, ran into a German position. They had to bail out their vehicles. Their vehicles were destroyed. Their 6-pounder destroyed. They managed to make their way back in foot, closely followed by one great big German that was trying to surrender. And Patsy Kinney was trying to tell them in no uncertain language to off the Germany sort of style. Anyway, it was a bit of a shambles altogether. We started running into these fanatics. They'd be hiding in bushes about 20 yards off the road. We'd fire a few shots, and then they'd put their hands up. Well, there was no way these people were going to get taken prisoner. Unfortunately, again, with a very, very bad incident, a very good friend of mine who had joined the anti-tank platoon with me in the Orkneys decided to go back to a rifle company. Sandy Elliott, who was a sergeant in one of the rifle companies, and he was the last man to be killed in the battalion. He got shot through the back of the head by a German sniper. Well, by the time we finished with that German sniper, I tell you what, there wasn't much of him left to bury. But again, that was one of these incidents, rather sad, and a married man with 3 kids as well. Now, as then we started, we ran into a roadblock manned by Germans, and we approached it with white flags up, and they agreed to an armistice, and they sent for, and we, in actual fact, 15th Scottish Division, escorted, who's a German admiral that took over from Hitler?
Donitz,
was it? Was it Kittel? Donitz. We actually escorted him, I believe, from Hamburg down to Lüneburg Heath to sign the armistice. But we were the first one to make contact with them. Although our job, the role was when we crossed the Elbe, was to turn left to take Hamburg, but apparently they declared it an open city. And it was eventually occupied by, again, our old friends, the 11th Armour Division, which was in our core. So the war, more or less, was drawn to a close, and we finished up in a village called Arnsberg, which is just short of Lübeck. We're told to stay there. And then we're told that the 8th of May would be the official armistice day, and we're then told to make our way up to Lübeck. And by this time, the 6th Airborne Division had captured Lübeck, or taken Lübeck. We finished up a little place called Travemünde. Although we did send our carrier platoon out on recce, and they reckoned they'd got as far as they could see Rostock up the Baltic coast before they managed to get in touch with them and pull them back. And there was some of the recce regiment there as well. And this time they made contact with the Russians. And they made a sort of tactical withdrawal all the way down, you know, in constant touch with the Russians sort of style, until we got to the sort of demarcation line, which was at Travemünde. And although the River Travi splits at that point, the Russians stayed on one side of the splits, like the V or a Y, and we were on the other. And it was then that we met our first Russian troops. And believe you me, they were a sight to be seen. There wasn't 2 of them dressed alike. There was hardly 2 of them armed alike. None of them could speak English. They were all of Mongolian extraction. They wanted to feed us with vodka. And I'm sure the same vodka they were drinking was the same stuff that they were driving their tanks with. It tasted awful. And then we found out that every time you touched them, we're getting scabies. You had no idea the state these people were in. So we made again withdrawal and kept well away from them, and gradually we could watch them, because we're only up the road from us, building their sort of frontier posts, you know, the barriers across the road and their sentry boxes. And it was about a week later, down came the White Russians, and of course we sort of lays with them, and then we withdrew, and that was the last contact we made with these people. Every time we would stepped over our side of the barrier, sort of style, up came the rifles. So we thought, well, there's no point in making an incident or getting ourselves shot unnecessarily. And then the next thing that happened was we're told to stay in a wartime situation. And we were put on patrols right down what we called our demarcation line through a village called Schlutop, and we're sort of based on in Schleswig-Holstein. And it was there that we actually saw the start of the Iron Curtain, which we've been warned about. And we actually saw the Russians moving in bulldozers, and bulldozed an area 800 metres wide, they reckoned. And they started at the Baltic Sea and worked their way right down to Berlin. Then up went a wire on our side and on their side. In between, they were putting mines. We could see them laying them. And also these lookout posts, which were manned 24 hours a day. And night and day, we could hear firing from the Russian sector. All night long it went on. Goodness knows who they were shooting at, whether they were just panicking or whether they were trying to keep us on our toes or not, I don't know. But then we started finding Germans were filtering through. And we're still finding a way across these minefields and through the wire. And we could do nothing but help them, because I haven't seen the way they're treating some of these German refugees. You know, we were only too willing to help these Germans to get back into the British sector.
How were they treating them?
Dreadful. Rape, pillage. You have no idea what they were doing to some of these women. As I say once again, and then we're having problems of our own. Our area was full of these displaced persons camps. And there was one particular area where we were billeted in a shipyard building U-boats. And up the road from us was one of these DP camps. And they were out every night looting these German houses. And one night we found three German men and a German woman hanging from a tree. The Germans were in uniform, I think they were Marines. I don't know who they were, I think they were Poles that caught them. And again, you know, we really were really annoyed about this, because it's things that we didn't do. We didn't treat people that way. And we told the Poles if we had any more of it, we'd seal the camp off and starve them. You know, there's no more food. Unless they behave themselves. You see, it's the only way we could control these people. And we threatened to take their leaders out and shoot them or hang them the same way they're hanging these people. So we gradually, you know, got control, but we had to use some quite ruthless methods at the time to do it. And eventually, as I say once more, this went on for weeks and months until we could ease people off our hands, but they still had to be fed, as well as the German population. So it wasn't a happy time. I mean, the story went round that when they sorted out the zones, the French, the American, and the British, we had all the Ruhr to look at. With all these German cities that had been badly bombed, and all the population was not housed. And the story was that the French had got the vineyards, or the vineyards, the Americans had got the scenery, and the British had got the problems. And believe you me, we had problems. Trying to contain that nation, trying to feed them, trying to get control. And it was this time that the Control Commission Germany started moving up amongst us to take over the administration of the country and get some order. But 2 days, or a day, 2 days after the war finished, we'll say, the commanding officer got us all together. Now, he was going off to promotion somewhere, Hank Morgan, getting promoted to Brigadier. And he stood in a plinth in the middle of the MT Square and addressed us all. And thanked us very much for efforts, and for those of us who's leaving the army, good luck in civilian life. And for those of us who stay in the army, hope we'll meet again sometime. And then he said, would those of you who serve with the battalion in the ordnance stay behind when you get dismissed? I said, I'd like to address you. And then when we formed up, he burst into tears and dashed off the parade ground. He says, is that all that's left? There's 90 of us had left the ordnance. So we sort of looked at one another. Most of them were all sort of cooks and clerks that had been at B echelon, and Even my platoon, there was only 17 of us left out of the 53 that had started off the war, plus all the people who'd been attached to, you know, the reinforcements that had been killed and wounded. So again, we'd suffered quite a lot. It was rather sad. The next day I was sent down to a place called Wan at WAHN, which is now Bonn Airport. At this time it was an RAF aerodrome. And they were putting me on what they call a ground-to-air control. And I was getting sent to the Far East to control airstrikes. So we started our course, and it was this time that during the assembly, when we were formed up, the RAF asked if any of you had flown before, and quite a few of the officers put their hand up. The MD would like a flight, and I put my hand up. Having heard all about flying from my father, who'd served in the Royal Flying Corps in the First World War. So they fixed me up with a flight, and lo and behold, it was a mosquito I was flying in. So I was sitting in a navigator bomb aimer's seat. The pilot asked me what I'd like to see. I said, like the bomb damage, I'd like to fly over the dam, as you know, which is in our history. So I had a bird's eye view of the damage done, and I can tell you now, Cologne, which we circled, where we're based, there was not a whole roof to be seen. But if every bomb that had hit it, then there wouldn't have been any Cologne left, because you could see hundreds of bomb holes all around that city where they dropped short or overshot or whatever. Anyway, I'd only get into the course after about a week when we got called together again to be told that the war in the Far East was finished, that they'd dropped a hydrogen bomb, or an atom bomb rather, in Hiroshima, and then 2 days later one in Nagasaki, and our service would be no longer required. So there's a loud cheer there, I can assure you, because I wasn't looking forward to heading for the Far East, having just spent 11 months from Normandy to the Baltic. So I was sent back to my unit, and then we got settled down into this business of the army occupation, and they moved us down from the what we call the front down to Stada, Buxta Hoodie. We stopped there for a few weeks, and then they moved us down to a place called Dean's Lacken, which is near Duisburg down the Ruhr. And it was then they got us together and said, right, we've got to move, we're going home, we're going to Greece. Now, at that time, we were due what they call leave in advance of Python. But the commanding officer said, as so many of your non-commissioned officers would be taking the battalion away if you stayed behind and go to some other unit. Well, we said, we're all Argyles, we want to stay in Argyle. So we like to discrub our leap and go home with the battalion. So the base is at Drimmin, near Loch Lomond. And we're only there for a couple of weeks. We were told that we're going to suspend an animation. So they broke up the battalion on, I believe it was the 17th of February, or thereabouts, or the 6th of February, I beg your pardon. And I was put on a draft as draft conducting sergeant to take a draft out to the 1st Battalion in Palestine. So we sailed from the Clydes in the beginning of February, having dug ourselves out of 3 foot of snow to get down into Glasgow. But by the time we reached Gibraltar in the troop ship, the SS Cameronia, we were sunbathing, and I spent about 4 months in Palestine. So we got called together one day, the draft from Argyll and Sion Highland, us to report the other room, and the commanding officer came out. There's, I think it was 20 of us, and he gave us a real lecture. We had no right to be there. We're all due Python. In other words, we'd done 3 years overseas at wartime and counted as double. So they sent us back home. So I came home to England, and I got a post in the Army Apprentices School at Chepstow, for where I spent my next 2 years.
Did you see any action in Palestine?
Not a lot. No, most of our job was what we call cordon and search. I never fired a shot in anger. With a few incidents where we rounded up quite a few of these terrorists who suspected terrorists. Although one night we nearly shot two people out of a telegraph pole, but it turned out there were Indians with turbans and signalers. And we were on this railway patrol, which was our main job, to keep the railway line open between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And our job actually was to occupy the high ground by day. Then we could overlook the railway, every section of it, right up into the town itself. And we put static patrols down below, were netted up in radio, and we kept in touch with them. So if we saw any movement at all, we had people on the ground that could go out and sort it out, you see. So that was mainly our job for about 3 months. But at night time, we did patrols on foot down the railway. We did a few raids around the villages looking for the Haganah, which is their home guard, and told to watch out for the Stern Gang and the Ergens Vialumi. So we had three different sections to look for. And at night time, we would go out with a captain who had quite a good name for himself. The name escapes me for a minute. And he had a big sniper's telescope, and we used to watch these flats and watch houses and things like this. So all in all, it was quite an interesting time, but the weather, the climate was absolutely fabulous. And at weekends, we were allowed out in groups to ground all these biblical places of interest. And in actual fact, we were stationed between Bethlehem and Jerusalem on a Bethlehem Road. So Bethlehem was only about 4 miles up the road from us, and Jerusalem about 1 mile to our left. So we had quite an enjoyable time then, but we didn't see an awful lot of action. Although I was on escort duty at the main, I can't remember the name of it, but they were trying Jews who had broken out Acre Jail, A-C-R-E, which is the north of Israel. And there was quite a number of these guys wounded, and we had them in courts. And I was the sergeant in charge of the escort for these people, so we'd escort them in, although they were all wounded. They were all sentenced to hang. It was, I think there were about five of them, I'm not quite sure, which wasn't very nice, I don't mind telling you, because you think to yourself, no, we'd seen Belsen, by the way, although we didn't capture Belsen, but on our way up through Germany, we saw the outpourings of Belsen, and were told to not to touch them, not to give them any water, not to give them any biscuits, don't to do it. In actual fact, we'd have done them a favour, we'd shot them, the state some of these people were in coming out of that camp. I think it's not something I like to talk about, because it was so dreadful. But again, we were sympathies that lay with the Jewish people, because having seen what they'd gone through in these concentration camps, you know, there were these people coming from Germany and places like that, out of these camps into Jerusalem, or into Palestine, and we were supposed to keep them out. So it wasn't a really mixed up session, especially when you're only 21 years of age. So to be honest with you, I was not too unhappy to believe in Palestine at the time under the circumstances. But shortly after I left them in Jerusalem, then moved down to Sarafand, and then they gradually moved back down into Port Said, and they come home. But as I say, by that time I was home. And took a job at the Army Apprentice School at Chepstow, which is 2 years, very enjoyable, training boys from 15 and a half to 17 and a half. And they were sitting for their education, their GCEs, not the GCEs, their City and Guilds. And most of them finished up getting them and went off to Remy units and engineer units as fitters and tradesmen. In the afternoons, we took them out in sport and on military training. So quite a number of them became officers. You know, I've been in touch with quite a few of them since my service there, and quite a great success. And it was about this time my 7 years was finishing, and I'd made my mind up then that if I signed on, which I did do, I was going to do a tour with the parachute regiments. So in 1949, I was up in Fort George. I was on a draft to the Far East, to Hong Kong, where I went to see the careers officer and said, I'd like to do a tour of the parachute regiment. He says, okay, if you can pass your medical, you'll be all right, which I did do. And off I went down to Upper Hayford to do a parachute course for secondment to the parachute regiment for 3 years. And no sooner finished my course, which was done in Dakotas, till I posted the 2nd Battalion of the Parachute Regiment in Aldershot, when the Korean War broke out. And fun enough, it was my regiment, Argyll and Sandhurst Highlanders, that went off into Korea along with the Middlesex Regiment, with the first troops to land there. So I formed up in front of the commanding officer and told him that Argyll, there was a draft going out from the parachute regiment. Would it be possible if I could join the draft? And he said, no. Well, very commendable sergeant, but he said, we'll all be out there soon enough. You will stay where you are. Now at that time, they formed up the anti-tank platoon. I put my name forward and I formed up the anti-tank platoon in the parachute regiment again, which had been made redundant, I think from the time they come home from Palestine in 1948. So this is now in 1951. Now in 1950 we could present it with the colours. In 1948, I'd done a drill course at the Guards Depot at Caterham. And when I joined the battalion of the parachute regiment, there happened to be an ex-guards RSM, that was RSM there, and having seen my record of having trained boys and having done my drill course, he asked me if I'd look after the boy intake, which were taking in band boys for the parachute regiment. I said yes. So I trained band boys for a long time, gave an introduction to the army, and took them through all their drill movements and all these other sort of things that you do for young soldiers. And one of them actually, who formed up there, Boy Williams, finished up as Lieutenant Colonel Williams, DCM, which he won in Borneo with the 2nd Battalion of the Parachute Regiment when he was a company sergeant major, headquarter company, or regimental sergeant major of the Parachute Regiment, got his commission and finished up as Lieutenant Quartermaster, the Lieutenant Colonel Quartermaster at the end of his service. So there's a success story. I set him off on the right foot and he carried on. And this happened to two more of my boys, actually from apprenticeship school. One, I believe, finished up as aide-de-camp of the Queen as Brigadier in the Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers, a chap called Gibbons. So I've been told. I've never met him since. So anyway, most of my life was training people. But anyway, to get on, when I joined the Paras, we then took over the anti-tank platoon. The next thing, we're sent up to Abingdon, which transferred the parachute school from Upper Hayford to Abingdon to do what we call a conversion course in double door jumping, having done Dakotas, my basic course. They then put us on to Hastings. So I did a Hastings course and did six jumps there. By that time, the battalion had moved out to Oakhampton and I moved down with them. I was only there 2 days when they warned us to stand by for a move to the Far East. So we're whistled back up to Aldershot, and within, a matter of a week, we were on our way to Cyprus on two aircraft carriers, the Triumph and the Warrior. So we sailed from Portsmouth, and it's only a couple of weeks before we'd been given the freedom of Portsmouth. So we marched through Portsmouth with the bands playing and our bayonets fixed. And a fortnight later, we're back down again getting on the boat. So it took us about 7 days to get out of Cyprus, and the object exercise, Masaryk had just nationalised the oil wells in Iran, and we were being sent out there to denationalise them. But when we got to Cyprus, they found they didn't have enough aircraft to drop us. So apparently they asked the French if they would lend them, and they said no, and we asked the Americans if they would lend us theirs, and they said no. So then we were stuck in Cyprus without enough aircraft to lift us. Now all sorts of things were happening. And the next thing that happened was that the battalion was flown into the Canal Zone to try and keep Farouk on the throne.
This is the 2nd battalion?
And the 3rd, and the 1st, were all there at the same time.
But you were with the 2nd?
I was with the 2nd, yeah. But prior to this, I'd been on an exercise in Cyprus with the battalion, and I was on a gun-towing tractor, as they called it. It was a Stuart tank with a turret taken off, ton of 17 powder, and we come down a U-turn, and the vehicle slid off the road, the weight of the gun pushed it over. Now, my height, sitting on top of the vehicle and looking down, and the drop was about 20-odd feet. Now, I'd been trained in the carriers all my life, and I've always said, if ever you go over, not to try and get out, but to get inside the vehicle and hold on. So my driver, Taylor, I think his name was, tried to get out, and I rolled back into the vehicle and held on to him and pulled him back into the vehicle again, and over it went. Unfortunately, two of my men were trapped, Mansfield and Baird, and both of them finished up losing their right leg from below the knee. The driver and I were trapped inside, and eventually they got us out, got us to hospital, and I was very, very badly banged up, the interior bruising, and I'd been covered by acid as well out the batteries, and I was in a bit of a state altogether.
Where did this happen?
In Cyprus. So anyway, I no sooner got myself better, I was sent home the 17-pounder anti-tank course, and it was during this time that the battalion flew into the Canal Zone. So I eventually caught up with them in Boxing Day 1951. And from there on in, we were in the Canal Zone in various places until we eventually reached Muasca, where we were sort of based as garrison troops in the town of Muasca itself. At this time, we were doing what they call cordon searches. And it was during one of these cordon searches that we're searching a graveyard in Muasca itself when my platoon commander was shot and killed, Lieutenant Acton. And what happened was we made a clean sweep through the yard very, very quick, captured quite a few of these terrorists, as we called it, discovered a lot of these tombs were full of high explosives. In fact, we got three ton loads out of it. The next day they were doing a more detailed search through it. And he was detached from me to a platoon of A Company, and he had one of these little Senussi trackers with him who tried to hold him back, tried to tell him that there was terrorists around. And when he approached this tomb, there were terrorists inside it, and they shot him through the chest, and it passed by, passed his heart, ruptured his heart, and eventually he died that afternoon. So again, that was one of these sad events when you've got to bury your own platoon commander. And I was a sergeant in charge of the